Well, this is good. This seems to me like the kind of intro that Colin Fleming should have every week. Here with us to talk about some seasonal favorites and classics, we are joined by our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Welcome, sir.
Kiki Riki, says the Spanish rooster.
I like that. I like that a lot.
You never seen that in school? Like, you it's what it says in Spanish class, and like you pull the little string and the rooster goes, Kiki Riki! It's like, whoa, what are you up to, dude?
I took French instead of Spanish, so all I got was a talking croissant.
Oh, you're a fancy man.
I am indeed. We want to talk about some holiday-themed delights today, and I thank you, and I did online, but I thank you here for giving me the opportunity to revisit some favorites, including I told you, maybe my favorite all-time episode of Cheers and one of my favorite television episodes of all time.
I did a double take when you, like, you gave me the official Kimball ranking. You're like, top two or three. And I had to know, was that for everything? Was that just for Cheers? And it's telling because you're like, that is for everything. But it sounds like you have maybe you have multiple Cheers episodes in your top 10. I didn't know you were so big on that show, but this is from, what are we in? We're in the third season, right?
I think so, yeah. Fairy Tales Can Come True, season 3.
Yeah, the October 25th, 1984 episode. And so within Cheersdom, Sam and Diane are broken up and they're going to try to hang out in a mature way post lovers, and we all know how tricky that can be. It's not going to be easy for those two, right? And so that's one love story of this Halloween episode. But you have a costume party at the bar, and your man, Cliff Clavin, who is probably one of my two, since we're ranking things, two favorite characters in all of television, the other being David Brent from the British version of The Office. And I've always liked Clavin, and he wasn't a huge part initially of the show, with John Ratzenberger sort of forced his way where they were going to have to make a way for this character. And he lives with his mother, and he's going to attempt to find love, even though he's completely insecure, doubts himself in every way. He's the one person at the bar that everyone seems to rank on. And he dresses up as this Lothario, right, for Halloween. And it's really the only thing that gives him any confidence.
Yeah, he is Ponce de Leon for Halloween. And then into Cheers arrives Tinkerbell.
I like that he's Ponce de Leon, too, because he loves Florida so much, right? He
right.
This Florida fetish. He has this dream, and people looked, it seems, a little bit differently back then, so how old is John Ratzenberger at this point? Like, he's in his 30s, right?
I would think late 30s, yeah.
He wants to go to Florida, which is usually what you'd be thinking about when you're 70 or whatever. But he is just gunning for Florida. So it's Ponce de Leon. And he's kind of smooth with this woman, right? Because he is donning this additional personality. And it makes him suave. And it frees it's not a pun, relax people, his tongue to make inroads with the fair sex.
Yeah, and it all plays out beautifully, and then a rendezvous is set up, and the woman doesn't show up, and we get to see, I think, really maybe the best range of acting that we saw from Ratzenberger in the whole series.
That's what you hang on. You want this little triumph. Because that's all really it's going to be, right? You want it to go well for this particular character. You don't need to have him end up in love and it works out swimmingly and all of that. You want him to have this success. Because you get the sense watching the show that he doesn't have successes. When he's maybe the employee of the month at the post office, he's the mailman, of course. But she is shy in the way that he is also shy. And you just don't want her to be dicking with him, right? To
right.
be leading him on. And you don't want to be crestfallen at the end of the episode. You want to see two people come together, at least in this circumscribed, quiet moment kind of way. And that's really what it makes for gripping drama. That's what you're tuning in for, and that's what you need to know. And it's not just that we need to know this. all of the people in Cheers need to know this too. And if you watch the episodes, and this one's a good example, people spend a lot of time at this bar, frankly, eavesdropping. That's what they do, right? They're like patrons at a play, these mini plays that happen throughout this place on Beacon Street here in Boston. So it does work out, spoiler alert, well for him. And it's not scary, but it's sweet. It went the way you sort of needed to go.
Yeah, and you get the delight of having Sam and Diane go on one more date. And then little tidbits like, yeah, everybody's in costume. Norm's not in costume. And then you just catch a glimpse of a Nixon mask next to him at the bar.
Yeah, things like that. And you could make Nixon jokes at the time. And there were actually a number of them on Cheers. And I don't know, it makes me wonder, like, do people probably dress up as Norm and go out? Norm had that. But Norm was like once bitten, twice shy. Because do you remember the earlier episode when he's trying to like impress his boss, who's also like sort of getting all handsy with Diane? It's actually really uncomfortable. And he throws this toga party, but he's the only one who wears a toga.
Right.
So I could say a little bit of intertextuality with Cheers, like Cheers went all metafiction. I could see Norm being like, no, I'm not doing that. I will just go as a morbidly obese alcoholic, and that will have to be the costume that carries the day.
Colin Fleming with us here on Downtown. We want to visit another television episode, this time from another one of my favorite shows, The Dick Van Dyke Show, and the terrific It May Look Like a Walnut. Rob and Laura watch a little creature feature, a little horror film on the TV, and getting scared to death about Kolak from Twilo.
It sounds like one of those, well, sort of one of the horror films that we've discussed. It almost sounds like a Creature from the Black Lagoon type film, but like a budget Z production of that. Like Robot Monster, if anyone's ever seen that. It's a guy in a gorilla suit in a cave in California and the diver's mask on. So I think that's the level of monster we're talking about here. And Rob is being that annoying guy, like that Mystery Science Theater guy who's making all these comments about, oh, this isn't believable, all of that stuff. And Laura is kind of tolerating him. And then they go into the next day. They go to sleep. They go into the next day. And everything is just a little bit off. It's not like massively off, but things aren't quite right. And what they're doing is they're riffing on a number of things. And one of them is, I think we both have a great deal of affection for Invasion of the Body Snatchers, but also, of course, the Twilight Zone, right? And a number of shows actually did this at the time. Bonanza did this. There's a Bonanza Twilight Zone episode with, like, Little Joe that plays off of that first episode of the Twilight Zone where the guy wakes up in the town and nothing makes sense, no one's around, that type of thing. But this is the Dick Van Dyke version. Dick Van Dyke goes to the writer's office, and Sally and Buddy, they don't help things, do they?
No,
because
no.
They're both such wise asses. Rob's like, this is messed up. I saw this guy. He's like this monster, and he breathes like liquid through his nose. And Buddy's like, oh, yeah. He just starts going with it. So he's not the type of guy to sort of talk you down from the ledge. He's going to increase the altitude of your ledge. And then we have that famous scene, right, where Laura is in the closet, and she comes out in the cascade of walnuts. And it's weird, because it's one of those sequences in a funny sitcom that, I don't know, it's somewhat disturbing. Like, it's a little, there's a creepy vibe to this episode, I would say, that's fairly legitimate.
Oh, yeah, and I love, you know, the genius of Carl Reiner, too, that how you know the aliens have taken over is that everybody's eating walnuts, you lose your sense of humor, and your thumbs.
The thumbs part is, that's actually a good trick, I feel like. That would be, you could see that in the Twilight Zone, that somebody has some small deviation from the norm. Like, I don't know, their one nostril becomes smaller than the other ever so slightly. Something like that. Like, some kind of tell that is believable. And thumbs are such a crucial part of our evolution. So I find that it's pretty clever pun. I eat a lot of walnuts because all you people out there concerned with these things, they're very heart smart. So anytime I am having walnuts, which I seem to do during the witching hour, maybe it's a Dick Van Dyke thing, I am thinking about this episode as I power down those nuts.
But you have both of your thumbs.
I do. But when I eat nuts out of the bag, I only use one hand. It's like my nut shoveling hand, which just referring to the walnuts. And the other, so it's not like I have eyes on my other hand. Things could be morphing just on one side of my body. But then when I wake up in the morning, it is there and I'm good to go and I can do all my twiddling.
Glad to hear that. All right. From there, we move to a classic of classical music, A Night on Bald Mountain. And I ask, would it be as popular today were it not for Fantasia?
No, I don't think so. Although, you know what? There are lots of pieces of classical music that were not in Fantasia, a Disney cartoon from 1940, that have certainly become part of popular culture. I think probably at some point we've talked about Danse Macabre, a number of things like that. Night on Bald Mountain is Mussorgsky, and it was orchestrated, this piece, by Cezanne, and it is quintessential Halloween music to me. And not just that it's limited to Halloween, because it's not like these people. I think sometimes we think this. They're like, oh, let's write a great Halloween piece. It's not like that. Just like Christmas, it's not like Handel was trying to write Hallelujah Chorus for your once-a-decade trip to Symphony Hall. It was actually, that in particular, was more of an Easter piece. But this is a swirling, shifting maelstrom of chords that is disorienting as a listening experience, but not in a vertiginous way that makes you feel like you're going to yak on yourself. But it's something that takes you far removed, I would say, from your comfort zone. And it just sums up, when I was a kid, there's this place in Massachusetts, I don't know if you're familiar with it, the Blue Hills Reservation.
Oh, yes.
And it's a big hill. And it's on Wikipedia, it says that it's the highest point on the eastern seaboard, which is so dubious. I don't know how that's possible, because it's just this hillock. But whenever we drove past that as a kid at night, I would picture that demon dude from Fantasia, because that's what he's doing, right? He's like a church at the bottom of the hill when Night on Bald Mountain is playing in that film. So it always was lodged in my memory, and I carried it around right from like the earliest days of childhood. I remember seeing Fantasia when I was quite young, and that was the one scene in Fantasia that has always stayed with me the most, I'd say.
And that arrangement by Leopold, by Stokowski, which is the one that everybody, I think, has come to know and love.
Yes, Mussorgsky, he would always seem to have his works picked up by somebody else who would sort of flesh them out. And I shared on Twitter the other day, I think Bruce Pratt and I were talking about the solo piano transcription of this particular piece. And I like things with daring do like that. It seems to me a piece that lists, for instance, would have tried to transliterate to the piano. Liszt would do that with, Beethoven's complete symphonies. He would even he worked at it for a long time. It wasn't easy to do. He took Beethoven's ninth, and he does, just to put this in layperson's terms, if you don't listen to classical music, there's a solo piano version of it. You can hear that. It's on YouTube, various versions by, obviously, Liszt is dead and didn't record it himself, but lots of other pianists. So to hear a pianist play this, though, it's a work of gymnastics. It's exhausting to play if you're just doing it on your own. Again, it's that hurdy-gurdy swirliness to the piece.
And what is it, Colin, in the musical structure of this, that even if a little kid hadn't seen Fantasia, I think if you played that, they would say, ooh, scary music.
It doesn't have a tonal center, so it's not rooted in like what you would associate. It doesn't have a kind of home root to it, like a home root chord. It's not atonal music, but it gives this vibe, this sort of refraction of what atonal music is. And people, atonal music, if you don't listen to classical music, it would be something like John Coltrane in the early 1960s, when he's starting to stretch things with that quartet of his. So he's moved beyond hard bop and Blue Train, and you don't even know what key a song is by Coltrane in that period at certain points, and it's hard to find that stable center to this. It's disorienting. It's not this, come here, you're in this safe zone, this comfort zone, this safe haven. It swirls. It makes you swirl. It's Malstromic.
Well, we move from there to another musical classic of a different stripe, one first recorded and released in 1962 by, well, a guy from next door to you, from Somerville, Bobby Boris Pickett.
Yes, and actually there's a Cheers episode, too, where they have the pranks, right, the bar wars. When Gary's Old Town Tavern, they make the jukebox lock on Monster Mash.
Right.
And Monster Mash is one of those songs, and I wanted to talk about this because it is such a part of the season and the culture. But you don't really listen to it. It's just, it's on. It's like, what's that, since we did Kiki Riki, what's that Spanish Feliz Navidad at Christmas time, right? You don't really listen to, like, wow, this is pretty zen, man. You don't hear the song that way. And Monster Mash, it's so clever. It really has a lot of witty lines and jokes in it. And it could only be written by somebody, I think, who loves classic horror film, because you have kind of these hidden jokes, these in-joke kind of deals, and this idea that these monsters are getting together. You have backing bands. It's like a battle of the bands. I find it just incredibly imaginative, and that's not how it's looked at. It's normally looked at like, oh, here we go again with this, and he's doing the Boris Karloff imitation. It might be the best Boris Karloff imitation there is, but I cherish it for those jokes, the reverie for those classic characters. Like we were talking last week, Dracula and Frankenstein, and I had said that Bela Lugosi was irked when he was offered the part, or he was maybe going to be the monster in the 1931 version of Frankenstein, because he thought that was beneath him. The Bela Lugosi character in this song, he's kind of prideful. Like he's miffed that he's not getting his just due. And he's with this cranking band, and they're all going at it. It's just clever.
And it's well constructed and features, among others, Leon Russell playing on it.
And the backing vocals, too. The backing vocals are, like, fairly sophisticated. It's like girl group doo-wop, really. Like, wow, wow. Like, there's a lot. They worked at this. And I am someone who actually listens to the album that it's on. And sure, there are a lot of kind of retreads of this. A little monster. It turns out, like, you could spread the Monster Mash like melted down peanut butter cups and make a lot of different concoctions out of it. So you're getting a lot of that, but the whole album's like 25 minutes long. And I don't know. When I was a kid, it was one of those things. I always associate horror not just with the macabre or the eldritch, but a certain cleverness, a certain cheekiness. We talked about Bride of Frankenstein. It's clever. It's cheeky. It has this homosexual angle to it that couldn't be overt. So it's a coded kind of horror film, and I feel like this is a coded kind of, I don't want to say novelty song, because it's a fairly rocking, rhythm and blues, well put together, witty song.
Colin Fleming with us on Dantana. And finally, we move to a sometimes overlooked film with Orson Welles from 1949, Black Magic, that featured in many ways Welles playing the part he played for much of his life as a magician, a charlatan, a faker.
Yes, and Welles was hugely himself into magic. He would be, like in the 1970s, he's out on the road, he's in hotels, he's trying to save up money through his acting gigs, playing some warlock or narrator or whatever it was, Satanist in one film. And he would take with him detective novels, like thriller novels. He loved pulp novels, and he subscribed to all these different magic clubs. He was a magician. He did floor shows himself with his magic. So he gets to be, it's almost like a blend of Welles the magician and the faker with Welles the character. Remember The Shadow? I've been listening to The Shadow a lot lately.
Lamont Cranston.
Shadow, he'd do all these sort of, I'm in your head, getting in there with the kinetics and everything and taking over people's minds and throwing the voice. And that's what this black magic guy does in this film. And Welles does a lot of the acting with his eyes, kind of the mad sorcerer type eyes. But he was stoked in this, steeped in this horror genre. There's more horror in Welles than we usually think. And this was one of the more solid horror films of the 1940s, which was a great decade for horror films.
And it also features, and I don't know if it was his first role, but a young Raymond Burr.
Right. Raymond Burr was just somebody who turned up in more things than you thought and could be in a film and you don't even really notice it until after the fact. And you know what also I think this film draws upon, too, is the ghostwriting. We've talked about M.R. James, but Casting the Runes is a M.R. James short story that is very much in the same mold. Now, I'm sure they cribbed a little bit from that M.R. James story, which also became Curse of the Demon, the Jacques Tenor film. And Wells plays that charlatan, sort of mad sorcerer guy. It's the same role. And I could have seen Wells being perfect for Casting the Runes, but this is almost like a bootleg version of Casting the Runes.
Well, it was so much fun to revisit some great classics for this time of year or any time of year. Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Visit Colin's website, colinfleminglit.com. Subscribe to the Many Moments More blog. And, of course, tune in next Tuesday when Colin joins us again. Thank you, my friend.
All right. See you, buddy.